The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You're going to love this show. You're just going to love this show. Freedom sounds nice, right? Well, what if we look at it deeper? Diversity. Well, that's worth doing. But a deeper look? Truth. Press freedom. All this hour, a deeper look into some concepts we value and think we understand, but sometimes crumble in the chilly winds of reality. Remember the internet? The internet? That old thing? Access to a universe of information and fellow users on a free, virtually untraceable computer node that you traversed with a few tools, a search engine, a text editor, and a simple browser for finding news groups, Usenets all over the world. You could set up voice connections and even video connections with a little bit of work on your own. Today, you think you go on the internet, but you actually go on Google, or you go on Firefox, or Safari, or Facebook, or Chrome, or Yahoo, or Bing, or Baidu, enabled by services like AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint, or some other corporate-owned cloud server. These corporate platforms are now what passes for the internet, and from them, corporations or anyone else can monitor, restrict, or share data with governments or Edward Snowden. President Obama has another name for this. He calls it net neutrality.
Ever since the internet was created, it's been organized around basic principles of openness, fairness, and freedom. There are no gatekeepers deciding which sites you get to access. There are no toll roads on the information superhighway. This set of principles, the idea of net neutrality, has unleashed the power of the internet and given innovators the chance to thrive.
Wow, that sounds great. Net neutrality does sound nice. Colorful language from President Obama last year when he was advocating for the FCC to protect net neutrality. But according to the latest edition of Freedom House's annual Internet Freedom Report released this week, digital civil liberties have been curtailed for the fifth year in a row around the world. And there are now more countries with heavily censored internet than there are ones with a completely free internet. Last among the 65 countries assessed is China. Is the U.S. with its net neutrality badge first? Susan Crawford, professor at Harvard Law School and a director of the Berkman Center for Internet Society. Susan, I'll put the question to you. Is the U.S. first on the list?
Well, first of all, John, great to be here. Terrific idea for a program. And no, the U.S. is not quite first on the list, but we're very high up, and we are among the countries that is treated as free by Freedom House. And the important thing the report is telling us is that for many countries in the world, 32 of them they're pointing to, freedom has been constrained over the last year when it comes to the globally interoperable internet that you just talked about, where anybody can speak, just plug in a device. That's a troubled future around the world.
So is my cynicism misplaced, or is that where we're headed?
Well, the future contours of the internet are definitely up for grabs, and there's a choice we're facing. Well, whether we're going to have this network that provides humans with choices and opportunities and self-determination, or whether China's and Russia's vision will be the prevailing one. The thing those two countries are more afraid of than anything else is an open internet. It's the thing they fight every day. And that vision is increasingly being adopted by countries that want to control their citizens. The U.S. has to have its opposing vision out on the world stage.
Does the open internet depend on everyone being open? For instance, is there a kind of critical mass where if most countries have a closed internet, it really doesn't matter who has the open internet anymore?
Well, I'm one of the people who really wants to see this globally interoperable network, not a series of intranets like a Russian internet and a China internet to which we can't communicate and they can't get out to us. It's about self-determination, freedom, the opportunity to thrive. That's a vision I want for everybody around the world. And it is important that we make sure to put pressure on those countries to keep that open.
Can we trust the platforms that we use, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Bings and Twitters that actually filter us from the internet? They keep us from the actual raw internet. And do we need to put our faith in them in addition to our faith in governments, or are they somehow collaborators with governments?
Well, in many countries around the world, what's going on is that governments are using the equivalent of a Staples Easy button. They sort of push on online platforms to constrain content that the government can't constrain itself. And this is leading to a lot of censorship around the world. We do have to trust companies and tell them to make sure to keep their platforms open as much as possible. There are a lot of good actors in this space. Companies are trying to tell us about the numbers of times they receive requests from government to constrain content. Google, Twitter, and Facebook are all doing that. LinkedIn, by contrast, has been actively constraining what it's up to in China so that they're making sure that people in China are not getting access to things that China doesn't want them to see.
So is there a government that can monitor who's good at their interactions with other governments, like, for instance, LinkedIn? Is that what the Berkman Center does?
Well, the Berkman Center has a lot of projects looking at the future of the open Internet around the world. I think that what's most important here is this snapshot that Freedom House is giving us of a moment in time when we could sort of tilt towards the Chinese version of the Internet or have an opposing vision that keeps the Internet open. Very interesting countries hang in the balance, like India, where 1.2 billion people could be online. Only about a quarter of them are right now. And they're viewed as partly free by Freedom House. Or Cuba, which is just coming online. Much of Africa. Who are they going to follow? And our hope, my hope, is that they look to the United States, Australia, Canada, the EU, as a model of openness, not just for economic purposes, but for the thriving of human beings.
Susan Crawford, professor at Harvard Law School and a director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Thanks so much, Susan.
Thanks so much, John.
What is the fight and discussion about internet freedom like in Russia, which is said to be not free, ranking 49th out of 65 countries on the Freedom on the Net list? Russia was once completely free, a Wild West zone of bloggers and commenters, until Vladimir Putin declared that the internet was a CIA project and began the effort to monitor and limit social networks last year. VKontakte, a Russian social network styled after Facebook, is now under state control, and its founder was ousted from Russia. But the internet leaks, and from boastful descriptions of military missions in Ukraine posted by Russian soldiers, journalists were able to learn that, indeed, Vladimir Putin's soldiers were on the ground in Ukraine. This fight for control is documented in a new book by Andrei Soldatov and Irina Borogan, The Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries. Andrei says the U.S. government and the Russian government have different styles of high-tech surveillance and very different levels of debate about government intrusion.
The biggest difference is that we do not have in our society political debate about privacy and surveillance. Even after Snowden went to Moscow, we still don't have this public debate. And the idea of the Russian control over the internet is to be focused on a few troublemakers. And here we are talking about targeted surveillance, which is incomparable with what you are talking here in the United States, which is mostly about mass surveillance. And people here are mostly concerned that data collected maybe unintentionally. In Russia, everybody understands that, yes, the state has great opportunities to collect data, but mostly they already have this list of troublemakers, and they follow and spy on these people. And the problem is that it's extremely difficult to try to get the society to this debate and to explain them why they should be concerned. As the biggest argument in Russia is, well, if I do not participate in any kind of manifestations, why I should care? And it's still a very strong argument. It's very difficult to explain people why it's a big problem.
There have been a lot of comparisons between what Putin seems to want to do with his territorial expansion in Europe and in Georgia and other places in restoring the old Soviet Union. Comparisons of Putin to Stalin. But in this book, it seems to me that the story that you describe here, the way Putin approaches technology and the internet, he's not like Stalin. He's something different. How would you characterize that?
First of all, it seems that Putin is all about tactical moves. He has no strategy, for example, to expand the Russian presence in neighboring countries. And remember that just 2 years ago, before the Olympic Games in Sochi, the major task of Putin was to please the West, just to show them that good and professional Olympic Games might be held in Russia. And he put lots of effort. His personal prestige was put to prove this point. And suddenly, in 2 days, he was so outraged by events in Ukraine that he decided to launch this offensive in Ukraine. So we think that Putin just react to many things. He always feels that he is on defensive against the West. He really believes in this paranoia about the Western plots. It seems that Stalin he might exploited this idea of paranoia inside of the country, but he has the idea of strategy to spread communism or Soviet influence, etc. And Putin, no, it's all about tactical moves and reactions.
Are most Russians, as far as you can tell, afraid of the government, intimidated by the government, or it's just a matter of working around the government and ignoring the government?
No, unfortunately, the situation is much more serious. Unfortunately, these technical means are used not to actually to block information or to spy on people, if we are talking about surveillance. They are used to intimidate. They are used to send a message to users. And in a country with a post-totalitarian legacy and mentality, ones need to be only reminded of what might happen. That's why the Kremlin is very skillful in giving some examples of repressions. And we have some people sent to jail for expressing their opinions online. We already have the situation that the climate is very gloomy in Russian social networks, and people are really cautious in expressing their opinions because they are afraid. So in this situation, the Kremlin is quite effective in intimidating the internet.
So how concerned are you about your own freedom?
The Russian idea of controlling the message is partly, maybe mostly, based on instigating self-censorship. And it's a very widespread feeling among Russian journalists because the rules are not clearly defined. Nobody knows what might happen. You might only guess what is allowed, what is not. So it's better to be cautious. We try to fight with this feeling because, of course, we are all victims of this idea of self-censorship. So sometimes we just think that it's impossible just to keep going. We have professional standards and we think it's important. That's all.
Andrei Soldatov, co-author of The Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries. It's out this fall. We're calling it the Day of the Great American Do-Over. Beginning today through Monday, 6,000 federal prisoners will be released under the U.S. Sentencing Commission's sentencing guidelines agreed upon last April. The Great American Do-Over, releasing prisoners, reclaiming justice. A grand mission, and with over 2 million people in prison, 6,000 is really a paltry start, but it's a start. And while the do-over starts with each inmate's challenging reentry into society, it continues with a redefinition of prison and our expectations of what happens there. And the do-over ends with a complete reexamination of how our justice system works or doesn't. We'll be talking about all of that over the next few months. But let's start where these inmates are starting, the first days and weeks back in society. For these offenders, years, 9 years on average, have gone by. Charles Simmons and Glenn Martin know the difficulties of this experience and the limited joys of freedom on the outside. Charles went to prison as a teenager the first time. Today, he lives in the Bronx. Glenn is a national leader and criminal justice reform advocate who spent 6 years in New York State prisons. He is president and founder of Just Leadership USA. Glenn and Charles, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what these guys are going to be facing, literally, as they walk out and are suddenly back on the street.
I mean, the only thing that's on your mind is freedom. The car, anything like that, especially when you return and you come into Port Authority. So just to see the people and buses is like the overwhelm them of that. And after that, settle into the reality settings.
You got to think of it like this, right? You're in a situation where there's no vehicles going 30, 40, 80 miles an hour while you're in prison. So even seeing vehicles whiz by seems so highly unusual. Even crossing the street is something that needs to be relearned because it's so intimidating. And then the truth is you're just wondering sort of where you fit in. I mean, think of a game of double dutch where you're trying to figure out how to sort of jump in the middle of this madness. That's a bit of what it feels like.
So those are the feelings the moment you kind of hit the street. And then you begin to ask questions, all right, so what's my place here? So what's my role? So how do I get a job? And all those kinds of things. And that's where you feel the wind maybe hitting in the face a little bit.
Before you come home, they have pre-release programs to help you with that, you know, and give you a little bit of pointers. But it's nothing like to reality when you come back into society and you release. So those barriers that you might have learned in pre-release or whatever, and the people that came up there, it's a different story when you return to the society and actually reality sets in and you see some of these people and you get them knows.
Using your experience, you know, these people are coming out, 6,000, and, you know, they're going to have had pre-release programs. Everybody wants this to work, apparently, because the federal government, you know, is really interested in this working. Where are these inmates first likely to encounter, oh, wait a minute, it's a little bit different than what they told me?
I think the first place where these folks are going to be a bit taken aback is the labor market. I worked with Diva Page and Bruce Western at Princeton about 8-9 years ago, where we hired young people to pose as job seekers with criminal records here in the New York City entry-level labor market, and found out that a white person with a criminal record has a better chance of getting a job than a black person who's never been incarcerated ever. And unfortunately, for employers who don't have any level of sophistication around criminal justice, like most people, they decide that they don't want to take what they see as perceived risk in hiring a person with a criminal record. As I said, I applied for jobs moving boxes around, making $16,000 a year, and couldn't land that job, even though 6 years later I was running a nonprofit with a $23 million budget and 212 people on staff.
But that's a very unusual story. I mean, most people aren't going to be able to do what you did.
I'm glad you said that, because people often do that, which is exceptionalize me. But the truth is, I was exposed to exceptional opportunities. I did go to college while I was on the inside. You're right. That is rare. But my most difficult day in prison was my last day there. And people often ask me why. And it's because I felt as though I was leaving behind some of America's best and brightest. And if my story is the exception, it's because of these very same barriers that we're discussing.
How would you describe the challenge of leaving behind the society and the rules of prison, where certain things you can be proud of, maybe even having a criminal record can be something of a trophy, and on the outside, realizing that everything that you value on the inside may be something that you have to hide?
Well, it was a trophy in the... Like I said, the early part of my younger years, it was like a celebration. You went to jail early on. That's what I got exposed to. It was like you came home from jail. I went in early. I went in at 18 and came out at 21. So when I went in, it was like, you know, I went in as a teenager and then came out as an adult. And I didn't really learn. So, but when I came home, it was like you came home from college and it was really jail.
What are people's ideas about what goes on in prison? Because people get popularized notions of what prison is about by watching TV and movies. Do people have a kind of worst-case scenario idea of what goes on in prison? So you say you went to prison, they immediately assume, you know, you were in some hole somewhere.
Yes, I mean, you know, some of the butt of the jokes be, you know, when you come home, it's like, did you drop the soap? That's like the number one thing, you know.
That's really scary.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, because it's a different world in there compared to out here. But for the most part, it's just about survival.
You know, if prison was what you see on television every day, our prison population would solve itself, right? Like, if it was all about rape and murder and pillaging every minute while you're in there, people would be dying every day and we wouldn't have to worry about it. That would be a great way to reduce the population as far as some people are concerned. But that's not what prison was like.
What advice do you have for these people who are coming out?
The advice that I have is network. The best thing to do is network, because being able to network and education, but networking, it might open some doors that people normally that don't have open, but somebody might know somebody that knows somebody. So network is very important, and we forget that.
I would tell people just never give up on their dreams. It's going to be really difficult. I remember exiting prison and owing $100,000 in fines, fees, restitution, and child support, and my first job was $16,000 a year. But I also know that 3 weeks ago, I had a meeting with our president of the United States, President Obama, about these issues. And so while everyone may not have that trajectory, but the truth is there are so many moments during the transition where you want to give up, and I would just tell people that in the end, your destiny is not written for you, but it's written by you, so you should remain focused.
Charles and Glenn, thank you so much.
Good to be here.
Really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Charles Simmons lives in the Bronx today. Glenn Martin is a national leader and criminal justice reform advocate. They both spent years in prison.
It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So Big John, the Tan Man, Mr. Speaker John Boehner left Washington yesterday after 24 years in Congress. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has more on the last day of Mr. Boehner's reign.
There was a lot of clamor in the Capitol as they were gearing up yesterday. A new speaker was being elected, and John Boehner was rushing onto the House floor to preside one last time.
I got to open the House.
I know.
And so Boehner set in motion the end of a 25-year congressional career, 4.5 years of them as speaker. Most mornings for those years, Boehner ate his breakfast at Pete's Diner, just 2 blocks from the Capitol. House Republicans put together a farewell video for Boehner this week. Pete's manager, Gum Dong, was in it.
John is a good friend of Pete's Diner. We never even call him Mr. Speaker. We always go, John, what do you want? You know.
It all started for Boehner back in 1991, before the contract with America, before impeachment, before Bill Clinton.
It's easy for those on the outside, and unfortunately, some on the inside, to engage in the latest national pastime of Congress bashing. We today, as freshman members, do not wish to become part of that fad.
Well, somewhere along the way, the freshmen became the old guard. Now, in 2015, Boehner was forced from his own speaker seat with his successor, Paul Ryan, pledging, that's right, reform.
Tomorrow, we are turning the page. We are not going to have a House that looked like it looked the last 2 years. We are going to move forward.
I started covering Boehner closely in about 2006 when he was House Majority Leader. Now, back then, smoking was still allowed in the Speaker's lobby just off the House floor. And Boehner, the chain smoker, would come out and hang between most votes. He would stand there and puff away and hold court with reporters. So for the price of getting the cigarette smoke dry cleaned out of your suit, you got great information.
My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
I used to sing that on my way to work in the morning.
That's how John Boehner stepped to the mics just about a month ago, announcing he was stepping down. He just finished up a wildly successful papal visit, years in the making. And from that little song, you wouldn't know it, but at the same time, conservatives were claiming the prize of the speaker's head that they'd wanted. But he loved the Happy Warrior Act. Boehner always had an appreciation for the dance, and he wasn't afraid to let you in on it. Last February, conservatives were going to the mat to defund Obamacare, using a Homeland Security funding bill to do it, and Boehner had to pretend that he'd go to the mat with them. And it led to this little exchange I had with him, and this one went viral.
With respect, Mr. Speaker, that your answers about what you're going to do are the same as yesterday. Mitch McConnell has said exactly what he's going to do. You know exactly what you're going to get. It's going to be a clean DHS funding bill. Are you going to put it on the floor? Are you going to kill it? Are you going to let him vote on it? Have you even had this discussion?
Well, when we make decisions, I'll let you know.
Boehner had his traditional real kiss for Nancy Pelosi on the dais yesterday as he relinquished power. I asked her if she and Boehner, both speakers of the House, ever commiserated about the trials of the job. She said they didn't, because they were both just so darn positive. And Boehner was a lot briefer in leaving than Pelosi was in hanging around.
I leave with no regrets, no burdens. If anything, I leave the way I started. I'm just a regular guy, humbled by the chance to do a big job.
And with that, John Boehner waved his box of crying tissues at the House, got a laugh, and retreated to the back of the chamber, a backbencher one last time. He got praise from Pelosi and then Ryan until he finally gave Ryan the hand across the neck, cut it sign. No more, he was saying, and he disappeared into the cloakroom.
Play it once, sir, for all time's sake.
Hoo-ah!
I didn't get a harump out of that guy.
Did you say wait?
Hey, what happened?
harumph about the wheat. It's Friday. We talk about movies. Kristen and Rafer are here. Kristen, you are what?
I'm culture producer for The Takeaway.
And Rafer?
I'm the co-host of Movie Date, and I'm a film critic at Newsday.
All right. We got three movies to talk about. The first one is Our Brand is Crisis. I love the premise of this movie. Here's a clip.
Let me make this clear to you. Please. I am the one in charge. Do you understand?
No. See, you're not in charge.
What did you just say?
Maybe nobody's in charge. Maybe we're all just rolling down a hill and there's no one at the wheel. I don't know. Sir, why can you not say what you're supposed to say?
Where's because I'm
problem?
Not just a puppet
of
for you to play
with. Of course
you
are. Of course you're a puppet. We're just pawns.
Political consultants / CIA agents. I don't know what to make of this here. Rafer, what did you think?
Well, that's Sandra Bullock playing Calamity Jane Bodine. She's an American consultant in Bolivia trying to get her guy elected as president. Billy Bob Thornton plays Pat Candy, her nemesis. This is based on the documentary from 2005, a real story. I think this film wants to be kind of partly a jaundiced satire of politics. Partly it wants to take you, into the war room so you can hear the strategizing. Somehow it doesn't work. I feel like it feels a little bit like an early episode of West Wing to me. It's all very familiar. A lot of talk about polls and advertising, et cetera, et cetera. And I think when it starts to get weepy and it starts to ask us to get all teary-eyed about the plight of Bolivia, it just hasn't earned the right. And somehow this movie just can't quite find the right tone.
Kristen?
I totally agree with you, Rafer, on this. And part of the problem is they didn't really know what to make Calamity Jane. In the beginning, she may as well be Miss Congeniality before the makeover. She's just clumsy and sloppy, and she eats lots of chips, and she's a hot mess, and then suddenly she's strategizing. But none of her strategies actually seem very groundbreaking, except for maybe one that I can think of. It was hard to get behind this movie, and in the end, it felt more like a crisis than a movie.
You're tough on Bullock, Kristen, I have to say. And Gravity, it was all breathing. Now she's a hot mess. Oh, my goodness. The number two movie here that we're going to look at this weekend is Truth, about a very, very, memorable, we probably still remember it, incident that happened at CBS News.
They're going to start an investigation, and CBS wants to appoint an independent panel to take a look at how the story is put together. And I'm going to announce it tomorrow. I'm going to apologize for the story on air.
Andrew asked you to apologize?
He didn't ask.
Dan, that's... surrender.
Dan is Dan Rather. Andrew is Andrew Hayward. These are real people being played by Kristen.
Kate Blanchett also. Let's not forget her.
Right.
She's
Mary Mapes.
And
yeah.
This is all about how she's a legendary producer in CBS history. And she brought this story to the fore where we're looking at then President George W. Bush's record during the Vietnam War, where he kind of, thanks to some calls, got to not be drafted, and then it looks at his record while he was serving as an Air Force pilot, sort of, here in the States. And she was somebody who was very important in the news world at one point. Abu Ghraib, she broke that story. But in this story, there's the question of, did she actually get all of her facts right?
And there were some documents that were not exactly authentic, and that's what brought Rather down. He stepped down. Mary Mapes was fired. We'll talk about that a little bit more later this hour. But what did you think of how they put this story together?
I was a little bit curious about this film when it first came out because I thought this was going to be sort of an apology or kind of a vindication of Mapes and Rather, and I think it does give them their due. And Kate Blanchett, by the way, is just incredibly good as Mary Mapes. She's fantastic. But I thought this film was actually really even-handed in the way that it shows how the process happened, what went wrong, the rush to air, and even though all the characters get to make their speeches and tell their side, there's always someone who can step in and say, yeah, but you didn't get the story right. It wasn't 100% airtight. And I thought it was
a great movie.
I really enjoyed it.
Agreement
loved it.
From Rafer and Kristen. Last question. Is Bradley Cooper a good chef in Burnt? We don't have time for a clip.
he's quite a sexy rock star of a chef in this movie.
He's a horrible man. He's abusive. There's nothing good about him. But we do have on this week's podcast a bit of a radio play of the movie, our own parody of it. So you'll see how we really feel about him.
Burnt gets burnt on the podcast.
Indeed.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Day podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and co-host of the podcast. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
You too, John.
And now the truth behind Truth.
You can't handle the truth.
Well, we can be adorable, can't we? Could Hollywood handle the truth about what brought down Dan Rather at CBS in 2004? For 15 years, Mary Mapes was a producer at CBS News working with Dan Rather. She broke the story of the prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib, as well as the story of Senator Strom Thurmond's unacknowledged biracial daughter, Essie Mae Washington. But in 2004, a report anchored by Rather questioning George W. Bush's military service brought Mapes' name into the spotlight in a very different way. The story suggested that thanks to help from his father's friends, Bush was able to serve in the Texas Air National Guard rather than in the Vietnam War. The backlash to the story was immediate and fierce. Charges of bias and document forgeries led to the sacking of Mary Mapes, while Dan Rather stepped down as anchor. Mapes relayed her side of the story in her book Truth and Duty, The Press, the President, and the Privilege of Power. The book is the loosely connected premise for the movie Truth, starring Cate Blanchett as Mapes and Robert Redford as Dan Rather. Mary Mapes joins us today from affiliate KERA Public Radio in Dallas. Mary, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
First of all, how does the movie contribute to our better understanding of what happened to you and Dan and, shall we say, Betsy West and other people at CBS and Andrew Hayward, for that matter, who were involved in all of this?
I actually do think the movie is quite accurate. And as a longtime journalist, I'm very fond of warts and all, even if it's my warts that are being displayed. I do think it hews very closely to my truth, to the truth of the people who worked with me, to Dan's truth, and to the truth of how this story unfolded and how the political response unfolded that ultimately sort of sucked us down. I thought at the time, and certainly with 11 years perspective, I think what happened was really a brilliant parlor trick. Political parlor trick, I should say, that is probably more akin to our brand is Crisis, the movie you also reviewed a little bit earlier, because it was about how you change the conversation from the truth of the story to a discussion of process and how you marshal an entire band of political partisans to back up your supposition.
It sounds like what you're saying in your 11 years of perspective here in hindsight and maybe looking at the movie and participating in the movie and thinking about how your book was received and, you know, the tweets from Fox News about your book, et cetera, that in a sense you played a game with political operatives in a very important story about the president and his war record, and you got outdone by players who just had way more tools and levers to pull than you did as a journalist. Do you think politicians and political operatives trump journalism?
Well, there were a couple of things at play here. First of all, I wasn't playing a game in terms of the story. That story is absolutely true, and I don't know how many Americans actually believe that George W. Bush served with distinction during the Vietnam War and when he was in the Texas Air National Guard. The truth is that he was allowed into the Guard because he had connections through his family, because he was a wealthy kid with political connections. The story we ran included the first ever public interview with former Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes, who was the guy who pulled the strings to get not just George W. Bush, but a number of other sons of privilege, the sons of oil billionaires, the sons of other politicians, even a number of Dallas Cowboys. Bush was part of a unit called the Champagne Unit, and that was where they stuffed, you know, the best and the brightest, the wealthiest and the luckiest. And I felt the story was tremendously important at the time, in part because we were marching off into another war of choice. Hundreds of thousands of Americans were going to fight a battle that George W. Bush and cabinet had decided was necessary, and I thought it was incredibly important.
Well, the stakes couldn't be higher. The stakes couldn't be higher. Yeah. So why did the documents business, in a sense, spoil all of that?
I think what they did was recognize that they really could not fight back on the facts of the story or the other information we had in the story and the other interviews we had in the story. And so what they did was recognize that the way to attack this was by looking at the process. I don't know I've ever heard of any journalist before or since who have been forced to authenticate documents, i.e., demanding that they tested the ink and the paper to make sure they were real. In fact, that certainly was not demanded of the Bush White House when they released documents all along. In fact, a day or two before our story ran, they mysteriously came up with some new documents that they had just discovered from Bush's record. And that kind of thing had been going on for a couple of years.
Would you have done anything differently? Do you wish those documents weren't in that story?
Well, it's interesting. I, again, with 11 years of perspective, first of all, every single story I did, whether it was the stories that I won the most praise for or the stories that didn't make a splash at all, I would do something differently. And I think you probably feel the same way about a number of shows. You look back and you wish you would have asked this question or said that. I wish I would have used this soundbite or that picture or changed the wording or emphasized something else. I mean, there is no perfection in journalism. Absolutely no perfection, because it's committed by imperfect people like me or you, and we can always do better. I think what we do is to aim for the very best we can do. If my career were the most important thing in all considerations for me, no, I should not have used the documents. If I were doing my job at the time, which was to be as aggressive as I possibly could in pursuing the truth of Bush's military career, I think I had to use things, anything that I could. I mean, part of my attraction to the story was that I live in Texas, and I had spent since 1994 being inundated down here with information about Bush and his lack of duty and what strings were pulled. And there is an almost sort of a 10-gallon hat kind of political power structure here.
That story is told once again in the movie Truth. Mary Mapes is a former producer for CBS News. The segment she produced for 60 Minutes 2, Questioning George W. Bush's Military Service, is the subject of her book, Truth and Duty. Mary Mapes, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now we're going to take a few minutes to talk about diversity, okay?
What in the hell's diversity?
From the very beginning, we have been a collective of individuals.
Race, gender, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. But for us, it goes way, way beyond that.
Organizations are realizing that their strength in the marketplace is linked to their ability to attract a cultural diverse workforce.
This video will equip you with the tools you need to work in a diverse work environment.
Hey, Scott. Hello, Steve. What is it like to be black?
Do we all feel better now? Diversity is something that is talked about a lot in the workplace. It is in the air, like the weather. But for all of the energy devoted to it, has diversity become an empty legal term denoting good intentions without the expectation of real change?
The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there.
Is Viola Davis taking the stage to accept her Emmy for the Best Actress in a Drama Series this year. At a moment when the issue of race and inclusion is at a particularly visible place in American discourse, can we get beyond abstractions and focus on some real concrete realities in the workplace? Why black workers and white workers view workplace diversity very differently? What does this mean? Why do workplace statistics tell us that disparities remain across all industries, despite all of the attention to this concept called diversity? Tanzina Vega, a digital correspondent for CNN Money, says diversity is a lot like a lot of other racial constructs. They reveal good intentions, but they can shield inaction at the same time.
I don't take issue with the word so much. And I think what most people are reacting to is the fact that it's used often as lip service, right? It's a word that has lost its meaning. It gives mostly white employers, if we're talking in the context of employment, a way to feel comfortable with saying, we want to have a diverse environment. Who's going to say no to diversity, right? Who's going to really go against that? And then it's not always the fact that you say that you want diversity and then it actually happens.
Are there, you know, jobs called diversity and, you know, belonging? And these are positions that are open?
These are real jobs that people have, yes.
And what do they do?
And these are, it depends on the company. I think you're seeing a lot of that emerging in the tech industry in particular, which has been sort of held under a lot of pressure right now to diversify it. And mostly that's coming from, I think it's a combination of sort of public relation disasters and social media, right? So a lot of the tech companies a couple of years ago were forced in many ways to release their diversity numbers. Wasn't really a surprise to those of us who work in a lot of these industries, but to a lot of folks, it was sort of shocking that the percentages were so low. And so as a result of that, the tech industry has started to create these types of of jobs, diversity and inclusion, belonging. And these folks are tasked with somewhat HR capabilities and also, you know, tasked with, quote unquote, diversifying and hiring a very multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-experiential, if you will, staff.
And all that sounds great, but isn't it?
Doesn't
also,
it?
I mean, isn't it also the case that, you know, if you want diversity, why don't you just hire minorities, people who aren't like you, rather than hire somebody who's not like you to watch to see if you are hiring people that aren't like you?
Here's where it gets really, really interesting, right? So a lot of people say, well, we don't know where to go. We can't find people that we're looking to hire. And on the flip side, you say people say, what do you mean you don't know where to go? If you are interested in hiring people of color, for example, you can go where those people are. You can go to historically black colleges and universities if you want to increase your black recruitment. What seems to be happening is that a lot of employers will look to their employees of color or their diverse employees, whether they be of color, LGBT, disabled employees, and will ask them, they'll put the pressure on them to say, hey, do you know someone that we could hire? We're really looking to hire a person of color or someone who fits whatever what they're looking for.
Which feels a little bit like, could you write my essay I have to have done tomorrow
right.
for the test?
So it takes the onus off of the employer, and it puts the onus all of a sudden on this employee who's now tasked with essentially recruiting. And there have been some conversations on Twitter in particular among journalists, a lot of journalists of color that I know, who are saying, you know, hey, why is it our responsibility to suddenly go out and look at your hiring talent pool? One of the things that I did that I thought was interesting this summer, there was a conversation on Twitter that I started about, quote, hashtag media diversity. And I answered that question. There was a website that some academics had put together to essentially pull talent of color, right? And so if you were a journalist of color, you would put a bio and a little photo. And so actually responding to that question, where are they? We can't find them, right? So that was one of the tweets I tweeted out. And that got, I think, 35,000 views, you know, just in a matter of a day or two, because it was such a basic answer to a basic question. The people are there. Find them. Oftentimes, I think, you know, what I hear from younger journalists of color in particular is that they're afraid to apply sometimes. They feel like, well, if I apply and I'm a journalist of color and another journalist of color applies, where they're only going to take one of us. So why even bother? And that's heartbreaking because I think it does reflect this sort of concept that's been talked about called the one and done concept, right? A lot of employers might mistakenly think that diversity means checking off a box. And so when you start to talk about diversity, part of what you need is not just hiring people at the lowest levels of the organization and saying we're done, but now we have to create pipelines where people can sort of move up, and that creates a different type of tension. That begins to unseat those that are in higher positions. That means if there are four white guys in the room, and we want to diversify that room, someone's going to have to go.
And all of a sudden, these so-called ceilings feel a little bit more like floors because it's all about the entry-level positions. It's not about management and mid-management. This is bigger than media, though, too. I'm wondering sometimes if the way we handle race in America is to create an abstraction like freedom or emancipation or post-racial society or diversity in this case, and create jobs and symbols, you know, Black History Month, that sort of thing, and then sit around and wonder, why haven't things improved? And indeed, that's what people say about diversity. Why haven't we achieved it yet? When, in fact, it feels a little bit like the symbol was a way of not achieving it.
Because I think when you're creating, and I agree, it goes beyond media. I think that when we're talking about diversity, and I go back to the one and done syndrome, you know, oftentimes it's let's check the box. Let's not think about what we're trying to reflect here. Let's not think about the fact that our workplaces, our newsrooms, our tech companies, whatever it is, should reflect the society that we live in. And anyone who's looked at the numbers recently and looks at the future forecasting of where this country is headed sees that we are headed towards a much browner, much more diverse, I hate this term, but majority-minority future in this country. So part of the issue is also not just hiring someone and then that person being the only one in the room who has to feel almost as like they're some sort of ambassador for their race or their ethnicity or whatever their diversity sort of metric is. The real question here is how do we grow that talent? People of color, particularly women of color, are paid significantly less than their white male counterparts. Assignment equity is something that I was thinking about too. It's not just enough to have someone who's working for you, but what type of job do they have? And this came up in the media diversity chat. I was curious curious not just who was a journalist, but who were the investigative reporters? Who were the people who were doing the big multi-part series? And also creating networks and support systems where quote-unquote diverse candidates feel that they have the same type of support as white employees do, which often is a big problem.
Tanzina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tanzina Vega is digital correspondent for CNN Money. And here's something to take with you today. 2.2 million, that's the number of people locked up in prison in the U.S. You know that number. But earlier this hour, I asked Charles Simmons and Glenn Martin, the two former inmates who we were talking to, about this weekend's federal prison release of 6,000 inmates. I asked them how many people they feel could be safely released tomorrow based on the faces they saw and still remember from their years in prison.
If we have a 5 to 10 year plan, we could easily release 70% over the next 5 years.
I'd go with 20%.
Wow. That's anywhere from 500,000 to 1,900,000 inmates released. That's something to think about. Give us your take. Tell us a story at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Have a great weekend.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.